Smoothcast, it's the Smoothcast. Smoothcast, it's the Smoothcast. Smoothcast, it's the Smoothcast. Smoothcast, it's the Smoothcast. Spoofcast.
Bonus!
Hello, and welcome to a special Spoofcast bonus episode. So life has gotten in the way for Adam and I, and we were not able to get out a new spoof breakdown this week. So today, instead, we have our fantastic conversation with author and critic Odie Henderson. He is the author of the wonderful book Black Caesars and Foxy Cleopatras, A History of Blaxploitation Cinema, as well as the chief film critic at the Boston Globe. So we talked through history of blaxploitation era, Oscar nominations, what it's like to be a critic, and of course, because this is the Spoofcast, we talked through I'm Gonna Get You Sucka, the blaxploitation spoof from Keenan Ivory Wayans, which we did review for episode 8, so go listen to that if you haven't. And now, on to the interview. Enjoy. Well, it's a great look, and honestly, we are really happy that you are here to speak with us today.
Thank you. So, I came prepared. I have my Abby cup.
Love
Abby,
it.
The horror movie. And I'm wearing a Black Caesar shirt. There's Fred Williamson.
Whoa.
Amazing.
That's good prep.
Yes. I come prepared.
So I guess I know we talk about it in the book a little bit, but I want to get into just like, what was your first experience with blaxploitation films and how did that kind of draw you and shape your eventual career?
Well, I mean, it's between, I'm not exactly sure what came first. I went to see my late aunt, Brenda, took me to see, Into the Dragon and Black Belt Jones. It was a double feature. You know, back then we had double features. They were cool. And I remember seeing Bruce Lee for the first time on the big screen, or ever, Billy, because he wasn't on television. Also, you know, this is 1974 we're talking about. I think I may have been the first time I saw like Black Belt Jones being a blaxploitation movie. But it could have been, I don't know exactly when, but around the same time, my older cousin, took me to see Foxy Brown and Coffee. It was a double feature of Foxy Brown and Coffee. And that was the first time I saw Pam Grier. And that's odd because when I was doing research for the book, I realized that Foxy Brown and Truck Turner were the usual double feature that AIP put out at the time. But they weren't, you know, beholden to that. You know, the theater could show whatever the hell it wanted to. And it was a double feature of Pam Grier movies. I'm not sure which came first, but those two things were around the same time. And I noticed, first of all, you know, a Black woman in power, you know, a very attractive Black woman, even for, you know, 4 or 5 year old me, in power. And that's not something I really saw on TV that I can recall at the time. And then, you know, Bruce Lee, I was into, my uncle had a black belt. So I was into, at least I knew what martial arts were. And so I kind of got hooked on both of those types of things, on martial arts movies and on what I would later learn to be blaxploitation films.
Where were blaxploitation films kind of as you were watching these movies and growing up, and how did you decide that like these are an important part of film history and I want to write this book?
Well, I mean, as a kid, I certainly didn't know anything about that. They were just movies, and a lot of them wound up on television when I was younger, you know, because obviously most of them are rated R, and my mother would not have taken me to an R-rated, but I take that back. She had taken me to several R-rated movies where I wound up watching a movie like this with my mom's hands covering my face. But under normal circumstances, you know, unless a cousin took me to see something that was, you know, not meant for kids, I didn't see things that weren't meant for kids. But I saw them on television, so I would see cut versions of them. And then when I started working in the video store, the VHS tapes obviously were uncut and they were accessible. And so a lot of these movies I saw on TV, chopped to pieces like Three the Hard Way, I saw uncut on video. And then there were some movies, again, that I had seen in theaters. But what happened was in 2008, I decided to do a series in February of 2008 called Black History Month, M-U-M-F. I did that on purpose because when I was a kid in grammar school, they had Black History Month, which is February, and it was sponsored by Budweiser. And so we had to cut the Budweiser logo out of the posters they gave us to put on the wall in grammar school. And they always told you the same thing, you know, such a Cliff Notes version of Black History. And so I was going to mock this, and I was going to write about all the Black movies I grew up watching and movies that meant something to me growing up and that nobody else is writing about. So as a joke, I decided to do this, and I was going to write a piece every day throughout the month of February, and I did. I wrote a piece every day off the top of my head from movies that I had seen. And it was a hit because Roger Ebert's editor, Jim Emerson, started to promote my writing on his blog, which was on Roger's website, which at the time was at the Sun-Times. So that's how I kind of came, you know, across Roger Ebert. I knew who Roger Ebert was, obviously, but I mean in person, like him knowing who I was. That was around the time. I did that for 5 years, just as kind of a joke. And a lot of the essays and chapters in the book are things that started there, that I went back and I filled in with historical detail and, you know, what was going on at the time and so on. So that's how it started. And then I was doing a book on Michael Schultz, the director, Black director, who at one point was the only Black director kind of working in Hollywood. He'd done Cooley High and Which Way Is Up and Car Wash. And I was just fascinated by him because as a kid, I saw his name and I assumed he was Black. But the fact that he was directing things didn't make sense because Black people didn't direct movies, at least in my head, he didn't, as a kid. And it kind of evolved into this book. When I was asked if I was interested in doing a book on Black exploitation, I said yes, and I wrote a proposal, and it wound up becoming this book. And Michael Schultz does make an appearance a couple of times, but it wasn't the book I originally intended to write. But what I thought was great was that there weren't very many Black exploitation books out. There was a book by Josiah Howard that I swore by when I was writing my pieces at the blog. And there were a couple of other books that were also quite good, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't really taken from my perspective, which I wanted to look at it from an old man's perspective on movies I saw as a teenager and as a kid. What did they teach me? What did I learn from them? And what do I see now that I'm experienced and older? And that kind of became the kind of crux of the book. It was going to be a historical journey through Black exploitation, that I was going to take you through kind of my journey growing up with it and understanding as a Black man what it had to tell me or what it didn't have to tell me, what was good and what was bad, and what I gravitated toward as a kid and as a teenager. So that was kind of how the book came about. And they asked me to write it, and I did. And here it is.
How long did it take you to write in total? And what were the biggest challenges and highlights as you were writing?
Well, you know, this was the first book that I wrote that got published. I had attempted to write a book before, and it didn't go anywhere, about the MPAA. So I'm kind of a ratings junkie, and my disdain for the MPAA is evident in a lot of my reviews. And also in the book, I did a couple of swipes at the MPAA. But, you know, I had to watch a lot of these movies over. Mm-hmm. Not because I didn't remember them, but because whenever I want to write something, I want to make sure I watch it, like have it fresh in my head. So I wrote about 80 something movies in this book, and the pandemic kind of helped me being trapped, kind of rewatched them even before I signed the contract for the book. I was watching these movies. And then also I had to go back and look at what I didn't know, because I'm a kid. And so I don't know what's going on in politics and in life. All I know was what's in front of me as a 5-6-year-old kid. So I went back to do research on the 70s from the perspective of an adult's perspective of the 1970s, not my perspective, and finding out what was going on when they were making these movies. I learned a lot of different things that, in a way, I kind of wish I didn't know. You know, movies that were never made. And I kind of touched base on that in the book. There was a Stevie Wonder musical, never got made. You know, Pam Grier and Tamara Dobson were going to do like a Thelma and Louise kind of movie, never got made. And just learning about the history of what people were saying at the time, what the stars are saying, what the NAACP and CORE were saying, what Black folks were saying, what film critics were saying. And that was a good education for me going to do this research. That the one thing I learned was you cannot write a book like you write an essay. So I was trying to write this thing chronologically. Like I was trying to write it from the beginning to the end. No, you can't do that. And it took me a little while to realize that that was an endeavor that was just bad. So you have to write it in pieces and then stitch it together. So that was the biggest lesson I learned writing this book, was you can't write it like top down like you're writing a review. You have to write it in pieces and then work your way from the middle back and forth.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure that a lot of our listeners don't quite have an understanding of the history of blaxploitation films and kind of how and why they came about. So, you know, obviously there's a great book. So if you're a listener and you don't know, go read the book and you're going to get a full history. But can you kind of give us just a brief overview of what's happening in Hollywood at the time that brought about the rise of blaxploitation films?
Well, sure. So in the book, I talk about what happened before Cotton Comes to Harlem. And Cotton Comes to Harlem is widely considered the first blaxploitation film of the era. So just take a second step back. What is blaxploitation? A lot of people consider it a genre, but I don't. I consider it an era. And in my book runs from 1970 to 1978, which I think is the prime era of the movies that fit into the blaxploitation category. The reason why I don't consider it a genre is because you have blaxploitation horror movies like Blackula, you have Westerns like Take a Hard Ride, you have dramas like Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich, you have action movies like Too Many I Can Name. So those are all different genres, aren't they? You have even comedies. So it can't be a genre if there's so many genres that supersede them. So I consider it an era. And this era consists of movies that Hollywood thought Black people wanted to see. So when Cotton Comes to Harlem was made in 1970, first of all, no one shot a movie in Harlem. Ozzie Davis did it. He was the third Black director hired by Hollywood ever. Gordon Parks preceded him with The Learning Tree, his autobiographical novel that he made a movie out of. He was the first Black director to do a studio picture, I mean. And then Bill Gunn did Stop, which never got released at all. And then Love Man Peebles did Watermelon Man at the same time that Ozzie Davis was doing Cotton Comes to Harlem. And Cotton Comes to Harlem was made by Samuel Goodwin Jr. He produced it. And it made money. And people were shocked because this was not a movie with a bunch of white folks in it. And it was surprised that Black people went to the movies. So that started the whole thing. But what kicked it off for sure was Shaft. And in 1971, MGM was going bankrupt MGM was going bankrupt so many times, it's not funny. But they were going bankrupt at this time. And so was 20th Century Fox. Fox had done a lot of these really shitty musicals like Hello, Dolly! And Star that cost a lot of money and didn't make any money. And MGM was being ransacked by Kurt Kerkorian for his casino in Las Vegas. So they were both going bankrupt, and they were going to merge in 1971. And in August 1970, Ernest Tiedemann wrote a book called Shaft. Well, he had the galleys of Shaft, which MGM bought. And in January of 71, they decided to shoot Shaft. They got Gordon Parks to do it in New York. And Shaft made so much money, it saved MGM from bankruptcy for a little while. And once that happened, Hollywood was like, oh, wow, Black people to go to the movies and they spend a lot of money. So that's what kicked off the entire era. So now everybody wanted to make a movie like Shaft or like Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which preceded Shaft by 2 months, but was an independent picture. But Hollywood kind of got onto this and they thought, let's make all, you know, when something is successful in Hollywood, they make 17 million copies of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what happened here. A lot of these movies came about, and then a lot of the Black directors, a lot of white directors who were making these films, but when it was a Black director or writer, a lot of times he brought in other people of color to work behind the scenes because the unions were segregated. So the one plus of blaxploitation is that a lot of people got their start, both Black and white, in the era because of these movies. And they were catering to a certain need, a niche market for, you know, little Black kids in the hood like me, who wanted to see a representation of our neighborhood on the screen. And also wanted to see Black heroes, because on television, you didn't have that. You didn't have, you know, you'd eventually get Sanford and Son the Jeffersons and so on and so forth. But if you were on TV in Black back then, you were probably a thug on Beretta or on Kojak, or you're getting shot by Dirty Harry in a movie. So this was a complete turnaround, and people wanted to see this.
So what was you kind of touched on it, but what was the general critical response of these films at the time they were coming out? And has that shifted in the years since?
Well, blaxploitation when Cotton Comes to Harlem and Watermelon Man and Sweet Sweetback came out, the word blaxploitation didn't exist, which is the reason why Melvin Man Peebles always threw a fit when someone said Sweet Sweetback was a blaxploitation movie. Blaxploitation, the term, came into being in August of 1972 because of Superfly. And the head of the NAACP in Beverly Hills, Junius Griffin, coined the term. He called it blaxploitation. And he was against it. And NAACP and CORE and Jesse Jackson's PUSH initiative were all against these movies. Now, keep in mind, this is before Coffee or The Mac or many of the movies that people know that are blaxploitation movies. Superfly, obviously, is something people know. But this is before some of the more egregious films had even been made. And it was still, we're still working in kind of tame territory here. And Junius Griffin coined the term blaxploitation. So they were against it. In fact, there was an entire coalition built to try to censor these films. And it got a bit of traction in Hollywood. So the bougie Black folks were against it. The you know, the college professors and so on. We're, you know, us ratchet people, we'd go see it. But it was funny because I don't remember who it was. One of the, you know, professor, somebody said, why are Black people going to see these movies and like making themselves look bad? And they just don't understand, you know, but people want to see. And people wanted to see, like Fred Williams said, people want to see me shoot somebody in the face and then light my cigar. This is what, you know, the audience wanted. They didn't necessarily want, you know, it's exploitation. You're not going to get, you know, it's not Merchant Ivory here. So there was a lot of backlash. From a lot of the Black Jesse Jackson and all of Ebony Magazine and so on and so forth against these films.
And has that, what's the temperature around these films today? I mean, is there still kind of a that distaste for them?
No, I mean, Elvis Mitchell made a really great documentary in 2022 called Is That Black Enough For You for Netflix. It's a fantastic piece of history on blaxploitation. You can't get away from tropes of blaxploitation. I mean, Tarantino was not the only purveyor of this type of thing. You see it a lot. You see whenever Samuel L. Jackson says motherfucker, you see it when there's a cool Black guy on the screen and you hear some music behind him where he's dressed to the nines. Or not even Black people, not white people are doing it. These tropes that come from blaxploitation. Every movie has a soundtrack. You know what started that? Superfly. Superfly the soundtrack made more money than Superfly the movie did. Without Superfly the soundtrack, there's no Saturday Night Fever, which is a white blaxploitation movie, mind you. There's no Grease. There's no Flashdance, which Flashdance was the soundtrack that made it so that every movie had to have a soundtrack album as marketing. Because soundtrack albums are marketing. You see the album, you hear the song, you buy the album, it reminds you of the movie, you go see the movie. So these things are still evident, and you still have, you know, there's blaxploitation parodies. Michael J. White does them. There's the Outlaw Johnny Black. There's Black Dynamite. You know, there's spoofs of these things still going on. I don't think that it had a that its reputation got even cleaned up anymore than what it was. I think it was maybe an overreaction to the negative reaction that happened initially. But people do still complain about it. And in my book, there's a line where I say, your outrage is not new. And I talk about how people were angry about these movies back then, but also people loved them. So you really can't escape this at all. It's everywhere. It's just not, people aren't making blaxploitation movies per se. But pieces of them are everywhere.
You mentioned it being an era. When and why do you think that era came to a close?
Well, when I started writing this book, I had a completely different theory. And my theory was that Jaws and Star Wars, these big blockbuster movies that came out, and to a lesser extent, The Exorcist, but Jaws and Star Wars specifically were the reason. And that coupled with the fact that there were more Black people on television and more positive roles. You had the Jeffersons, you have Get Christy Love, you have Sanford and Son, you have more Black people on TV and bigger roles. And TV is free. Well, it was back then. And Star Wars and Jaws were movies that have no Black people in them. In fact, we liked Jaws because we knew the shark did not eat Black people. So we'd get in the water. And so that's what I thought was happening. The blockbusters and TV killed blaxploitation. And then I interviewed Elvis Mitchell. And he said it was The Wiz, the 1978 movie adaptation of the Broadway musical starring Diana Ross, directed by Sidney Lumet, that ruined it because it was a big budget black film that did not make its money back. It was not a flop. See, that's the misconception that The Wiz was an incredible flop. It wasn't, but it was $12 million over budget. In 1978, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So since it didn't make its money back, Hollywood said, oh, the hell with that. We were making movies with no black people in them, and black people are going to see them, which is ridiculous because we were doing that before. And so they just cut the tap off. So I wound up merging those two theories in my book. I never really gave them The Wiz any thought whatsoever because I didn't really consider The Wiz a black exploitation movie, but it didn't really matter. It was a black cast in the movie. I don't think there's a single white person in The Wiz. So that was just, you know, it's directed by a white person, written by a white person. They're behind the camera. So they blamed us. Hollywood did.
Well, so you talked a little bit about tropes that you're going to find in these movies. And I do want to get into I'm Going to Get You, Sucker, because as you're talking, I'm noticing some things that I might not have recognized as tropes in blaxploitation films and how that is parody. But before we get to that, I just want to get your stance on spoof movies in general. As a critic, what do you think of this genre of movie?
I'm a huge Mel Brooks fan. You know, obviously I grew up with Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles. You don't understand a single joke in Blazing Saddles as a kid, except for the farts. and I grew up with the Airplane. I mean, these spoofs. And there's even a blaxploitation spoof in blaxploitation era called Darktown Strutters, which is very hard to find. But you can see it. It's a very, very strange movie. I can like them. But then what happened was all these horrible things like Meet the Spartans, an epic movie, and they came out and they were just all garbage. And I kind of felt like, oh, God, another spoof movie. So, I mean, I'm of mixed feelings about it. I mean, I do love a good spoof, but there are sometimes few and far between to find. They're usually just basically spoofing of the moment. And that's not how you survive. You know, Blazing Saddles is still playing 50 years later because it's a spoof of a Western. It's not a spoof of any specific Western, although there are pieces of Westerns that it's making fun of. And Young Frankenstein is a spoof of, obviously, a Frankenstein shot on the Frankenstein set. But it's also a spoof of other things, Hammer movies, and so on and so forth. So you can pick a lot of these things out that don't age. Whereas Meet the Spartans are an epic movie. Meet the Spartans is obviously a spoof of 300. Now, is anybody talking about 300 right now? You're not talking about 300, so they're damn sure going to talk about Meet the Spartans.
That is, it's fascinating because we are not critics. You know, we work in the documentary space and we just love movies. But that is one of my biggest complaints and critiques of these movies when we watch them is that it is just topical BS that is not actually trying to elevate material and make it funny and comment on something. Like,
right.
One of the funniest jokes I have seen in any of these movies is in Mel Brooks' Silent Movie, where they're crossing their fingers about, we want to get this movie made. And so they're about to go in, they're crossing their fingers, and he can't get it uncrossed. And he just passes it on to other people. Like, that is a timeless joke. And it is so funny. And I've never thought of doing something like that. But tying that to I'm Going to Get You, Sucker, how do you think it balances, you know, paying homage to that era of film while also offering this kind of comedic critique?
Well, but before Hollywood, I'm Going to Get You, Sucker came out, there was a movie called Hollywood Shuffle, which was written by Keene Ivory Wayans and Robert Townsend and directed by Robert Townsend. It was made the year before. Mm-hmm. And this is the first really true spoof of blaxploitation movies, but not just of blaxploitation movies, of black roles. So Hollywood Shuffle is a little bit bigger in terms of what it's going after. It's just using the blaxploitation trope as its kind of entry point into its parody, its satire. And Keene Ivory Wayans is in both I'm Going to Get You, Sucker and in Hollywood Shuffle. And Robert Townsend was in Cooley High. So he was in movies of this era, of the blaxploitation era. And that movie was basically kind of pointing out, it's a lot sharper and meaner, it's satire than I'm Going to Get You, Sucker is, because I'm Going to Get You, Sucker is more, it's a little more loving of the blaxploitation genre than Hollywood Shuffle is. Hollywood Shuffle is mocking Hollywood and also how Hollywood Shuffle got made, you know, the whole story behind Robert Townsend and his credit cards and all that great independent movie thing that goes back to Melvin Van Peebles. But before that, so Hollywood Shuffle came out, and then There were some attempts to bring back blaxploitation in the 80s. Technically speaking, blaxploitation went underground, but it resurfaced as movies like Beat Street and Disorderlies and Crush Groove, these less on the show rap things that are based on rap and based in the urban area. So blaxploitation kind of was reborn as this underground movement of those types of films that were going on, which led to something like Hollywood Shuffle, which leads to I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. But before that, Fred Williamson had tried to bring it back with a movie called One Down, Two to Go, which I believe is 1981. A regular straight kind of, you know, blaxploitation film. And 2 years after I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, Curtis Mayfield and Ice-T teamed up to do the soundtrack for The Return of Superfly in 1990. So this point in 1988, when I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker was made, was kind of a perfect point for Keenan Ivory Wayans. He just happened to get lightning in a bottle in terms of catching a movie where the people who grew up with blaxploitation would have been old enough to understand it. And the people who, like my age, would really get a kick out of it because we were rediscovering or discovering blaxploitation through the video store.
Do you remember seeing it for the first time?
I did. In fact, I went to check because when I was doing the book, I fell in this rabbit hole of checking the New York Times ads when something came out and to see if my memory was correct as to what theater I saw it at. And 95% of the time I was right, which is really scary.
Wow.
I saw I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker the weekend it opened, which would have made it January 14th, 1989. I saw it at the State Theater, which is now defunct. I had no idea it was playing at the Newport Theater, which still exists here right up the street from me. That's where I saw it. So I do remember going to see it. I do remember my audience because the State Theater was the theater you went to for the rowdy black movies, you know, and the zombie movies and all the horror. It was a genre theater, basically. It was a grindhouse. And I remember the audience's reaction, which was just insane. I mean, every joke just hit. Because again, the perfect timing of the spoof and the rediscovery of these movies, or even if you're a kid and just saw them on television, you're like, oh, I remember that. And I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker is full of actual like references to these movies. I watched it again a couple of nights ago, and I remembered a lot of them, but I was surprised and I caught several more. Like, oh, that's that movie that they're making fun of. So it's very, very, it's made by someone who loved these movies clearly and who wants to poke fun of them, but actually is deep enough to give you a reference to a movie that maybe six people saw.
And I think that was one of the most disappointing parts of us watching this film is that there was so much that just went over our heads because we are not well-versed in this era of filmmaking. And I was just disappointed in that sense that I don't have a deep enough knowledge of that to really connect with it. But looking at the main character, Keenan Ivory Wayans, you know, what were the typical archetypes of main characters and how does he kind of subvert that and make it comedic?
Well, for starters, you know, he's a wimp.
Yes.
Which doesn't, you don't get that in the blaxploitation movie. You don't get a character who's the main character who's trying to be a hero. You get in a boxing movie, you get the guy that wants to try to be the hero and is coming from nothing. You know, and in a drama, you get that. In blaxploitation, you got to be badass when the movie comes on. So they're basically casting a unlikely hero as a blaxploitation hero. And then surrounding him by the genuine article. That's what makes it so funny. You know, I tell younger people about how Airplane hit harder in 1980 when I saw it than it hits for anybody after that. Because Leslie Nielsen wasn't funny. In 1980, he was a cop. He was in Forbidden Planet. Peter Graves is on Mission Impossible. Robert Stack was Elliot Ness. You have to understand that this is the same thing happening in Get You, Sucker. You have this point of reference where it's perfect timing, where everybody is going to do something that is either new or surprising. And that's what makes it funny. You know, comedy is, you can't let, in a comedy, you can't let people know that you think you're funny. And so with him doing that, he's basically stacking the deck by saying, okay, I'm going to get this wimpy character and I'm going to surround him by a genuine article. I'm going to make him the hero. So that's how it starts. I mean, it's the whole premise of casting him. He would not have been a blaxploitation hero. At the end of the movie, technically he kind of is, but you know, he would never have survived 5 minutes in 1973.
You mentioned the experience of being in the theater watching with a crowd. Do you remember anything about like the cultural relevance or what critics were saying around the time? Do you remember any like feedback or if this was a movie that was going beyond just that one theater experience?
Well, it did get some good reviews, but I'll never forget that Siskel and Ebert had one of their biggest arguments about this film. And Gene liked it and Roger did not. And at the time, I didn't kind of catch why. But when I was researching my book, I discovered that Roger didn't review a lot of blaxploitation films. You know, when Roger and I talked about the era, I knew he had done Coffee, and he told me some stories about the theaters in Chicago back in the 70s. But I noted that Gene reviewed all of them. And so Gene liked it. Roger thought it was offensive. And so they had a big fight about this. But I think some of the New York papers liked it. It was somewhat of a bigger critical success than almost any blaxploitation movie, that's for sure. But the other thing that what Keene Ivory Wayans does that's timely for the 80s is interesting is that he makes a joke about overdosing on gold, which played like gangbusters in my theater because this was the era of gold chains. 1989, everybody had a gold chain. I didn't. I don't like jewelry. So I have a watch and that's it. And, you know, it's rings don't fit on my fingers. So my pressure makes my fingers swell. So I can't wear rings. So I was never into the gold chain game. But it was a big deal. And the whole scene with Bernie Casey talking about the gold chains and fake things, it was funny because it was real. I mean, you can get your gold earrings snatched out of your ears, gold chains snatched, get killed for a chain. And so in the 70s, it was drugs. All the blaxploitation movies always start, the ones that were anti-drug, that is, like Coffee, started with somebody dying of an overdose. And then the hero is going to get revenge against the pushers who gave the so-and-so drugs that either killed them or put them in a coma or did whatever it did to them. That's the beginning. So he changed it and made it gold instead of, you know, drugs. So that's when he starts. I think the only contemporary kind of move in the movie is that replacement. But it serves the same purpose because in the 70s, people were anti-drug. You know, people were pro and anti-drug, but the drug movement, you know, it was a big deal.
Sure.
We had someone like Pam Grier as Coffee going against these drug dealers. So it was a very funny, you know, how does it go to bathroom and all that shit on? I mean, it played super well.
And what did it mean for the film to have some of the legends in it, you know, like Isaac Hayes and Jim Brown?
Well, that's what makes it so great in that, you know, these characters, not that they never played in any kind of humorous role, but it's the same thing that goes back to what I was talking about Airplane. You didn't really have Jim Brown in a comedy. That didn't serve a good purpose for Jim Brown or Isaac Hayes. Well, Isaac Hayes has done some funny things, but he didn't have it. Bernie Casey, these are all blaxploitation, legends. Two of whom were football players. Bernie Casey and Jim Brown were football players. So that having them there added an extra layer of fun, of humor, because we knew who they were. We knew what they were about, and we knew what movies they had done. So them playing on a kind of, you know, spoofy versions of themselves, it was very funny.
In that idea of, you know, timing and being of the moment, do you think that this movie, at least humor-wise, would still be relevant today or would work today or be received well?
I think it would, because I think more people know about blaxploitation movies than they did before. You know, I mean, after 1989, I'm talking about. I think it would play well, especially if you know, what it's referencing. So, for example, Ruth Carter, this is one of her first movies that she worked on, Ruthie Carter, the costume designer who won the Oscar for Black Panther and did a lot of Spike Lee's movies. I interviewed her, and there was a question that was burning in my mind for decades. Is Antonio Fargas, who is in more blaxploitation movies than anybody else in the universe, and he's usually playing like he's Huggy Bear on Starsky and Hutch, and he's, you know, a pimp or usually that kind of a player in these movies. I wanted to know about the fish in his shoes. And I was like, who the hell comes up with something so ridiculous as a guy walking around with aquariums in his shoes? And I learned that in the script, Keene Ivory Wayans had written that Fly Guy has fish in his shoes. And she said when she saw that, she remembered that there was a New York Giants football player in the 70s named Frenchie Fuqua. And Frenchie Fuqua had fish in his shoes. And so when she saw that, she goes, oh, Keen and I have the same recollection, the same memory. So she designed those shoes.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And that outfit is based on King George's outfit in Coffee. He has a giant, extremely yellow outfit that obviously they play up and make ridiculous and then they just suck. I mean, it was ridiculous in Coffee, but it's 1973. So, you know, colors in the 70s. So it's based on that outfit that Robert Dupuy wears in Coffee. It's a big yellow outfit. She just added the fish in the shoes and a giant hat. And then she put it on the number one pimp in Blaxploitation, Antonio Fargas. That's what makes it funny, because it's that whole purpose. Now I'm mocking this character that made me somewhat famous.
Wow. That is deep. That is, see, that, yeah. It's just,
that's the layers.
I love that. I think that's fantastic. And so kind of to that, you know, your depth of knowledge about just films in general, I kind of want to transition into just your work as a film critic. And just in one section of our podcast, we look at some of the top critics' comments about some of these films. And I just read some of the short snippets and we kind of talk about them.
Okay.
But I want to talk about you in general and how you approach writing a film. And if you have preconceived notions, or like, how do you just go into a film and start thinking of your review?
Well, I don't think of my review when I'm watching the movie, because I, first of all, just a really quick bit of history. I don't come from this environment. I was in programming. I was a techie. I went to school for computers. I have a degree in math and a degree in computer science theory. And so I wrote on the side, but my main job until 2022 was I wrote code. And so I come from a scientific background, a mathematical background. I love movies. I've been watching movies just like Scorsese. You know, the two things Scorsese and I have in common is that we both are asthmatic and we both were stuck in the house watching $1 million movie. 20 years between us doing this same thing, but we did. $1 million movie was still on when I was a kid in the 70s. It was what Scorsese watched, his original introduction to film, his history of film, seeing movies with his in movie theaters and watching $1 million movie. Same thing for me. And in the house, I had a lot of time to watch them because you can't breathe. You really can't go outside, can you? And so, you know, to me, watching them, I just watched the movie. And then as I got into reading every film critic in the universe, including Pauline Kael, who was writing in the New Yorker magazine, you go to the doctor, you have highlights, you had New Yorker. I was a little bit too old for highlights. So I would read the New Yorker magazine and I would read every film critic I got my hands on to read. And then Roger and Gene were on television. I decided I wanted to be a film critic. I wanted to be Jimmy Breslin. I wanted to be the critic that has a column, the journalist has a column, a beat journalist. And Roger and Gene made me want to like to write about film. So when I go to the movies, and it doesn't make a difference if I'm reviewing a movie or not, it happens the same way. I take notes now when I do movie reviews, because if you're at a festival, you're seeing six movies at a time and they blur together. Also, I'm getting old, so I kind of need to take notes a little bit. But I don't like sit there and go, I'm going to look for the cinematography and look for this. Something will strike me. You know, something will strike me. I take a great example of something like Nosferatu, which I didn't care for. But I look at the cinematography. I know what this director is. I know what his thing is. I know his movies are visually stunning and empty. That's kind of what's in my head. So I'm going in and I'm expecting something to visually stun me. Whether it's empty or not is up for grabs. So that part is missing when I go see his movies. I just know that I'm expecting to be visually stunning. And cinematography is my favorite element of a movie. So I love the way movies look. I love the way the camera moves a certain way. You know, I learned these things reading books and my own history of watching movies, what all this stuff means. But I didn't get it out of initially that I go to school for this. So I think it gives me a completely different perspective on how I watch a movie and how I review it. So it's to me, I just sit and I watch it, and movies are reactive, or you're supposed to react to it. It's supposed to do something to you. And so I'm waiting for my reaction. And that's kind of what I go off of. Obviously, if there's a bad performance or if they like, you know, something's wrong with the aspect ratio of the movie or something like that, I'll see it. But to me, it's not like I'm going in with that. I love movies so much that I just want to watch them. And, you know, writing about them is a plus. But if I never wrote another movie review again, I'm not going to be sad. But I never could see another movie again, I'd be very, very upset.
Mm-hmm.
I just watched them, and then I put what I know into effect when I read in the review. I have to give you some information. I have to give you some, maybe a little bit of learning, something you may not know, or pointing out something you may not see. I mean, that's what I feel my job as a critic is, to kind of point you toward those things and also point you toward movies you may not go to. Because it's much harder now to, when I was a kid, you got what was on television. Whatever they put on, your ass had to watch it because you had no choice. Now everything is right, Netflix and all these things you can stream. You can just watch what you want to watch. Whereas back in the day, I had to watch what was on. So I got a better history. I got a better education about film because I got to watch Joan Crawford. I got to watch, I may not have, what 5-year-old black kid wants to watch Joan Crawford? Well, I suppose if you know that you're gay, you might want to watch Joan Crawford back early enough. But in general, this is not something that's going to grab you in 1975, but it was on. So I watched this, and I know who Joan Crawford is. I know who Barbara Stanwyck is. And it gave me an education, whereas nowadays, a lot of people just watch what they want to watch. They can choose.
Yep.
And the fact you have choice kind of throws you off when you decide to become a critic. And you need to learn a little bit more about what else is going on in this world besides outside of your little, what happened before you were born.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. Like, what do you think the role of a critic is, and has that changed from the past to today? Because, when I read a review, I feel like I tend to just read reviews of movies I've already seen just to get.
Which you should. Don't read the review before you see it.
Yes. And I wonder if you've come across, like, most people that are reading reviews haven't seen it yet, or they have and they're just.
No. I'll give you a great example. Mm-hmm. A complete unknown, the Bob Dylan movie, which I hated.
Really? Okay.
It's number 10 on my 10 worst list.
Is 10 worst or is 1 worst?
No, 1 is the worst. Okay. That was Argyle. It was my number 1 worst movie of this year.
That was rough.
Mm-hmm. A complete unknown was just basically, and I'm not the biggest fan of Bob Dylan. I think as a songwriter, he is probably one of the untouchables as a songwriter. But as a singer, no. Also, I'm not a boomer. I'm not some old white boomer who is going to, like, look at Dylan and see nostalgia. Look at Timothy Chalamet playing Dylan and see nostalgia. And so my review ran Monday. The movie came out Friday. Monday, I had 400 comments under my review. Now, I don't read the comments under my review, ever. Don't ever do that.
Smart.
But the people email me because they know I don't read the comments. So I was getting people screaming at me and calling me everything but a child of God. They hadn't seen the fucking movie. So a lot of times people don't see the movie. When they write me, they wound up getting cussed out because I'm like, you didn't see the movie. You got nothing to say to me. So shut up. When you see the movie and you have a complaint, then we can talk. But more often than not, they haven't seen the movie, or that we're not going to see it, or I don't want to see it, but I think your review is mean. No. See the movie and then come back and tell me how wrong you think I am. I'm willing to buy that, into that. But don't tell me, the movie hadn't even come out yet. It had only been seen by critics and people at a film festival. And, I hated it. But I think people don't. And I tell people, we give you a star rating, so you don't have to read the review. If you just want to know what I thought of it, the stars are right there. It tells you what I thought about it. I liked it or not. Or if you're evil, you can go to Rotten Tomatoes and see what the tomato is on my reviews. And mind you, I do not load my reviews in Rotten Tomatoes. There's a mysterious person who's been doing this my entire career. As long as Rotten Tomatoes has existed, my career precedes it as a critic. Someone has been putting my reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. And it ain't me. But thank you, whoever is doing that. You don't need to read my review before you see the movie. And Nope, a movie I was going to review, I wanted to know nothing about it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to walk in completely blind. Now, I come from an era where critics would tell you the end of the damn movie. So spoilers never bothered me. But this one in particular, I said, I'm going to see if I can avoid every single thing about Nope. And I walked in completely blind. And that's almost impossible to do in this era. But it's doable. All I did was I didn't watch a trailer. There was an article about it. I didn't read it. I walked in completely blind. And it's very easy to do. You do not need to read. I'm not wiring your eyes open using the Ludovico method and making you read my reviews. This is on you. you spoiled something. I remember I wrote about Titanic and somebody wrote me saying, a spoiler alert. Like the boat sank in 1912. And Rosebud's a sled. And Norman Bates is his mother.
That's good.
Has becoming a reviewer professionally changed your enjoyment level of watching movies? Like now that you know going into it, I'm going to have to like talk about this and pay attention in a certain way as opposed to just take in what I take in of something?
Well, because I always talked about movies with people. I always talked about with my friends or the few friends that were as deep into movies as I was. There's always a conversation. You go see a movie, you talk about it with your friends. It's no different. I'm just actually writing it down. There's really no difference. In fact, I try to make my reviews sound like I'm having a conversation with you. That we're having a conversation about the film and I'm pointing something out or telling you about something. To me, it didn't change. Being a critic, and I've been a critic 19 years now, it didn't change my love. Now, on the downside, a lot of shit I see I don't want to watch. Mm-hmm. That I'm like Argyle. That I'm forced to watch. And that can get tiring sometimes. You know, you have like 5 movies that week and 3 of them sound like something that's not up your alley. It doesn't mean you won't like them, huh?
Is that the ratio?
No, it depends. Like, so Christmas week, I had 7 reviews. I think the record is 8 I had in a week. But no, it's usually 2 or 3 in a week, sometimes 4. During like the summer season or during like Oscar season, it's much more, a lot more. But you know what you might like and you know what you might not like. And I try to explain my biases in my reviews all the time. I tell you what I like and what I don't like. So you know up front, if I don't like the particular type of movie in general and I give it a negative review, that's grain of salt time. You know, well, this is not his thing. So maybe he didn't like it because it's not his thing. It has nothing to do with the movie itself. And I'm very open and honest about that. You know, I try to tell you, you know, but sometimes I go in a movie I think I'm going to love and I hate it and vice versa. So I don't even think about my own thought process when I go to a movie. Oh, this sounds like it's going to be a slog. But when lights go down, it's, you know, blank slate. I'm giving you, it starts off 4 stars. You know, if the movie is projected and it's not crooked, that's 4 stars up front. And then it goes down or up. Well, it can't go up from 4 stars, but it can go down. During the movie, in my head, I'm kind of calculating this in my head a little bit. But no, unless it's something like a director I truly can't stand, I don't go in with any kind of truly preconceived notion.
Hmm. Well, speaking of cinematographers and cinematography in general, I just watched Evil Does Not Exist the other night. It was a blind buy for me. I knew very little about it. I saw it on a bunch of lists, so I bought it on Criterion and I watched it the other night. And I was blown away by the cinematography in that film. I thought it was just insanely beautiful and just such a touching piece.
Yeah, I saw it at the New York Film Festival a year before it got a release. I eventually reviewed it. That's the thing about festivals. You see something and you have to wait forever and ever. Like, there's a movie called The Life of Chuck, which is the best thing I saw at Toronto. It would have been my number one movie of the year had it come out in 2024. But it
based on Stephen King?
Stephen King was there.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. And I had actually read The Life of Chuck, so I knew it was going to happen in the movie, and it still affected me so profoundly. And didn't get a distributor. Now it's coming out in May of 2025. But it won the Audience Award at TIFF, which is usually what gets you the Oscar for Best Picture.
Hmm.
So since it didn't come out, there was no, you know, thing. But sometimes you have to wait so long to review a movie from the festival that kind of drives you up the wall having to wait. At RogerEbert.com, we reviewed it right off the bat. We were just website only. You know, the paper's got to print it. So there's different rules about that. But no, that was a great movie. That was the director, he did Drive My Car and Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. Which I prefer Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy to Drive My Car that year. But no, that was his follow-up movie, and it's a gorgeous film. And it's, you know, I love cinematography. It's one of my favorite thing about a movie. And also, you know, I have a visual impairment, so I'm half blind. And I wasn't born this way. This happened when I was 14. So that's the other thing that adds to how I look at a movie or how I watch it, because I'm always afraid I may miss something because of my you know, being one eye, having one eye, and knowing what it's like to watch a movie with two eyes. I know what it's like to see, to be able to perceive 3D. Let me put it that way. And so it makes me a little more, pay more attention. And sometimes you get burned for it. You watch these Netflix movies that are designed for you to go on your clothes and come back 20 minutes later. Mm-hmm. And I sit there and pay attention like a dumbass. And I always get mad. Like, you know, why am I paying attention? I can walk away and come back in 20 minutes in the movie. I won't miss anything.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, so I do have, I mean, I think that's one slightly different thing than most critics who you know, don't have to worry about their vision.
We're recording this in the immediate aftermath of the Oscars nominations getting announced. Do you have any thoughts on this year that you care to share?
Oh yeah, I wrote, I did my piece right after the nominations. Every year I do this right after nominations as a response, and I write it. And you know, the Oscar nomination morning was such a big deal for me growing up. Even before I got into football and baseball, it was the Oscars. Mm. Before the Super Bowl, you know, before I became a football junkie and so on. There was the Oscars and the whole thing about the night of watching the show and that kind of thing. And I love movies so much. And I thought that they meant something. And of course they don't really, but no, this year I was quite unimpressed. I was kind of pissed off, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Marianne Jean-Baptiste not being nominated is absolutely the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. It's like, you know, say, you know, Brad not being nominated for On the Waterfront. You know, it's clear that the AMPAS is still a bunch of old white guys who are only going to watch a movie with black folks in it if it's traumatic, it's trauma in it. Hence why Nickel Boys, which is my number movie of the year, and Sing Sing wound up getting a couple of nominations, whereas this movie about, you know, and you know, black women dealing with mental illness and rage didn't give me, I don't think they watched it. You can't tell me she's won every critic award there is, including ours, the National Society of Film Critics. We New York, LA, and we agree. There's something to be said for that because that never happens. You know, New York has a different state of mind than LA does. And so you remember LA gave Do the Right Thing Best Picture and New York did not that year. So when you have consensus like that and the Oscar doesn't happen, nomination doesn't happen, there's something corrupt about that. But so no, I've always been excited about Oscar night, always. And this is even back in the 80s when the movies, these bloated epics that stunk. And this year was the first year I can actually feel like, you know, if I didn't watch the show, I'd be fine with that. And that just depresses me to no end because there were some really great movies this year. You know, and I just feel like maybe I'll feel better a little later. But I did take a swipe at a complete unknown again, especially James Mangold getting nominated for director. I figured they dropped him for Coralie Fargier, and she got nominated, but they dropped Edward Berger.
What was that?
I mean, we've seen the DGA, and the DGA is always a good harbinger of what's going to get nominated, the Oscars. Mm-hmm. And the winner of the DGA is usually good bet. Whoever wins the DGA wins the Oscar. I think it's been wrong 9 times, and 5 of those times is that the person that won the DGA, like Ben Affleck and Spielberg, weren't nominated for the Oscar.
Mm. Wow.
So yeah, no, I mean, I feel like maybe I'm just, it's still early. It's only been a day, but some of these things like Amelia Perez getting 13 nominations just pissed me the hell off. And I didn't hate Amelia Perez like most people did. I gave it 2.5 stars out of 4. I said it was a fascinating hot mess. It is definitely not, you know, not, I gave it a negative review, but I'm like, you know, this is, I came out of the theater going, what the hell did I just watch? Which for me is always a plus.
Interesting. Adam kind of makes that argument a lot on our podcast that sometimes when you just kind of walk out like baffled and you don't know what you just saw, it's almost like better because it sticks in your mind in some way. But that is one of 4 that I haven't seen for Best Picture. And
what are the other 3?
I'm Still Here, The Brutalist, and...
The Brutalist? Hold on a second.
I can't forget.
Hold on a second here.
I was hoping I would get them as screeners. Ta-da. But yeah, I'm part of the WGA and I did not get a number of them.
Oh, this is WGA though.
Right. And so there were a number of them that I did not receive as screeners, which is disappointing. So
well, go ahead. I mean, Go see. You have to see it in the theater because it's VistaVision. So you have to see it. You know, they haven't made a VistaVision movie since 1965. This is the first VistaVision movie made since 1965, and I guarantee it was the first one with a hand job in it.
Well, we don't want to keep you all day, but a couple quick hitters. What is your favorite movie of the year?
Of last year, Nickel Boys was my favorite. Nickel Boys, then it was, I'll do it real quick. Nickel Boys is one, Hundreds of Beavers is two, Hard Truth is three, Flo, the cartoon, but the cat was four, Sing Sing was five, six was the Wild Robot, seven was Thelma, eight was Hitman, nine was Conclave, and 10 was A Real Pain.
Wow.
Those are my top 10 of 2024.
Finally, people, someone showing love to Thelma. I loved them.
I love Thelma. And Richard Roundtree, Shaft, his last performance.
Oh, yes. Wow. It was great.
It was great, too. Yeah. I had such a good time. And I saw it at the festival. And let me tell you, the audience is with her.
Yes.
They were with. I mean, I love something. That's the best part of seeing a movie sometimes is the audience is with the movie. Mm-hmm. It really, really can elevate your experience.
Yep.
What is your favorite spoof movie?
Oh, Blazing Saddles, easily. I've seen Blazing Saddles so much. You can put Blazing Saddles on and turn the sound off, and I can give you every line of dialogue from that movie.
Nice. We haven't watched that one yet.
I did not mention Blazing Saddles in the book directly, but there is a chapter called What's Happening in the Clean World, which is a line directly from Blazing Saddles, which is the line that Cleavon Little says after his night with Lily von Stupp. And he goes back to Gene Wilder, the Waco kid, a.k.a. the Deputy Spade. And he comes in and he goes, look what the cat dragged in. And Cleavon Little says, what's happening in the clean world? And that's a chapter title in my book.
That's cool.
So what is one of your... I guess we'll call it a bad movie or a B movie. What is your favorite B movie, bad movie, I guess? What, you know?
I love trash. So, I mean, you're asking the right person, but, you know, people are like, you're such a snob. I'm like, I like Cocaine Bear. I like Megan.
That was so fun.
Cocaine Bear is good.
Cocaine Bear was fun.
Yeah.
And Megan was fun, too. You know, the first movie I saw last year was a movie called Night Swim. And my review of Night Swim is me basically taking myself behind the woodshed and whipping my own ass for liking genre movies. Because I said, okay, this is a humbling experience because this is the one genre movie that I can't say anything good about. That basically, like, you've broken me. Like, I'm broke now. Like, I don't know how to fix this. That I'll buy anything and I couldn't buy this movie. Wow. And, like, I've been broken. But, you know, I grew up, well, I wrote a book on exploitation movies. I grew up on this type of thing, The Grindhouse on 42nd Street in the 70s. So I have so many movies that I love, but I'm going to try to be a little respectful, a little more respectable here. And I'm going to say Them. The 1954 Warner Brothers movie about the gigantic ants, which is a fantastic movie, genre or not.
Mm. Okay. Amazing. Let's see, one more before I want to get your stance on Hollywood in general at the present moment, but do you have a favorite cinematographer, if you love cinematography?
Oh, God, John Alonzo.
John Alonzo, okay.
I'd love to write a book about John Alonzo. I mean, there are other cinematographers I could name, Gordon Willis, James Wong Howe, and bunch of other people I could name, but the first person that came to my mind was John Alonzo. He shot Sounder. He shot Lady Sings the Blues. He shot Chinatown. He shot a lot of movies. Mexican-American cinematographer that doesn't get enough praise and credit. And so I wrote an essay about him on my blog. I mentioned him several times in my book. I'd love to write a book about him, but he was so flexible that he was able to, and he was also one of the few cinematographers back then that knew how to light Black people properly. You know, Gordon Willis is another one. The Prince of Darkness can light a Black person and make them look good. John Alonzo may be my favorite simply because he's not revered enough.
Love it. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on where Hollywood is at right now?
Well, you know, they've been saying cinema's going to die forever. And I said, can it hurry up and die so I can change careers again? you know, TV was going to kill cinema. You know, this is streaming is going to kill cinema. You know, the problem is, and this is funny because you can make this direct statement 50, 70 years ago that I'm about to say. They keep making the same type of movie. They keep making all these Marvel movies and DC movies. It's kind of died down a little bit. But in its heyday, like Avenger Nod, there's a Captain America movie coming out in a couple of weeks. I got a review. I didn't see the last Captain America movie. I am not watching any of this stuff on streaming or Marvel on Disney Channel. I'm walking in like, I don't know. I have a friend who's a comic book person. He's the person I go to and say, explain this to me. I sound like an idiot when I'm reviewing this movie. And I come and go, you know, go in with something. But the same thing they were saying about Westerns in the 50s. Westerns were cheap. Westerns were popular. And they were just overrun. Look at how many Westerns are made. People were saying exactly what I'm saying right now about Western 70 years ago. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything is cyclical. At this stage of the game, I wish Hollywood makes movies like One of Them Days, which just came out last week. A nice little small comedy that has legs and gets plays for a couple of months in the theater. And it's alternative to, you know, the big spectacle pictures and the Marvel movies and so on and so forth. A little small movie, a little small drama. That's the other thing about me being a critic. I try to point out at some points little dramas that I enjoyed, little movies I enjoyed. You know, I'm always kind of trying to be a proponent for the little movie that could, whenever possible. You know, I had more leeway when I was writing for a non-print outlet because it allowed me to write about more movies. But I do try. I think that's one of the important things. Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel turned me on to so many movies as a teenager. I would never have seen Stop Making Sense, which is perhaps the greatest concert movie ever made.
100%.
Without them talking about it on their show. And Gene wasn't even that high on it. He liked it. He didn't love it. Roger loved it. Gene was like, it's good. And I went to see it not knowing who the hell the talking heads were. And so I love when someone writes me and says, this little movie that I never would have heard of, would go on to see, I went to see because of your review. So I do. I wish Hollywood would make more types of movies like that that cater to an alternative audience. It's how Tyler Perry got rich. It's how Black Exploitation movies became about, and you know, and these genre movies came about. You know, people wanted to see them. They were hungry for something like that. And I think Hollywood has become too run by people that don't know shit about movies. Now, you say what you want about Zanuck and Harry Cohn, that bastard, and Jack Warner. They at least love movies, you know. They love money, but they also love movies. Where now you just have someone like Zaslav who just loves money, is going to make a movie and drop it for the tax, you know. So that part of it irritates the hell out of me. I remain somewhat cautiously optimistic that certain movies will find their audience.
We love to hear that. And, you know, a lot of sentiments in there that we completely agree with. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Where can people find your views so they can go be nice to you after they read a nice review?
Oh, God. I'm the chief film critic of the Boston Globe. So at bostonglobe.com, you'll find most of my stuff. If you want a little bit of history, I wrote for RogerEbert.com for 11 years. I occasionally do a piece for them. I did three for them last year. I was at the Slate Movie Club last year. So I show up at other places, but primarily I'm the chief film critic of the Boston Globe, and bostonglobe.com is where to find me on Fridays and Sundays and occasionally Wednesdays.
Amazing. And go check out Black Caesars and Foxy Cleopatra's A History of Blaxploitation Cinema. I read
the book on the audiobook. So if you've enjoyed hearing my melodious voice, as Isaac Hayes says in I'm Gonna Get You Sucker when he's singing Grazing in the Grass, you can hear me read my entire book, all 304 pages of it.
Amazing. Cool. Thank you so much again. I really appreciate this. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Rower.
Grabs.
Spoofcast.